Samson, the grandson of Moses, and Usain Bolt, and Adolf Hitler, Walt Disney, Sam Walton, Jay Van Andel, Margaret Thatcher, Martin Luther, Martin Luther King Jr., Leonardo da Vinci, Marie Curie, Ernest Shackleton, and Amelia Earhart have in common? Ambition. Most of humanity's great discoveries, our technological advances, our medical innovations, going to the moon, as well as our cultural and social advancements, such as the end of slavery and the beginning of the civil rights era, have been accomplished by ambitious men and women who not only had the strong desire to achieve something great, they had the willingness to do the hard work necessary, the determination required to do so. They were driven by ambition. You might have noticed that I slipped Adolf Hitler into that list of world and culture-changing people. If nothing else, Hitler was ambitious. Oh, he was motivated to do great evil, and he was very successful in doing great evil. But ambition itself is actually neutral. It is the desire to achieve something, often something difficult. What makes ambition good or bad is both the motivation behind the ambition and the intended outcome of that ambition. I mean, pursuing hard science to improve, say, medical care. That's great. Pursuing hard science in order to make a better bomb? Not so great. Today, we will see the consequences of ambition when it is selfish, and we will see the real alternative that godly ambition offers us. Will, last week, covered all of chapter 18, but we're going to take another look at the end of the chapter, at the big reveal, and we're going to dig deeper in that. So we're in Judges 18, starting in verse 27. But the people of Dan took what Micah had made, and the priest who belonged to him, and they came to Laish, to a people quiet and unsuspecting, and struck them with the edge of the sword, and burned the city with fire. And there was no deliverer, because it was far from Sidon, and they had no dealings with anyone. It was in the valley that belongs to Beth-Rehob. Then they rebuilt the city and lived in it, and they named the city Dan, after the name of Dan, their ancestor, who was born to Israel. But the name of the city was Laish at the first. And the people of Dan set up the carved image for themselves. And Jonathan, the son of Gershom, son of Moses, and his sons, were priests to the tribe of the Danites until the day of the captivity of the land. So they set up Micah's carved image that he made as long as the house of God was at Shiloh. When we look at the book of Judges as a whole, there are lots of patterns that emerge. And see, God instructed his people to take the land he had given them. Under Joshua's leadership, they entered the land of Canaan, and wherever there was armed opposition, Israel met on the battlefield, and Israel was victorious. God gave them the victory every time they entered into battle. But sometimes, in faith, sometimes the victory came without a battle, or sometimes it came with very little battle. Jericho, for example, was conquered largely by the people of Israel marching in circles while worshiping the Lord. We see a similar tactic in Gideon. Remember Gideon? The Midianites were oppressing Israel from afar. They weren't from in the land. They were outside the land. But their armies would show up every time at harvest, every year, and they would steal all of the crops and any additional animals that were born that year. So God raised up Gideon to defeat these oppressors, and God instructed Gideon to take just 300 men into battle, only they weren't going into battle with weapons. They carried torches and trumpets. Their job was to worship the Lord as the Lord defeated the Midianites by sending them into confusion and having the Midianites fight each other. Over and over again, we see God calling his people to enter into the battle in faith that God himself may give them victory. Now, under Joshua, the people of Israel entered battles faithfully. Then Joshua died. And right away in the book of Judges, in the opening chapter, something changes. Joshua dies in the opening verse, and Israel inquires of the Lord, as they were supposed to. God tells them Judah must go into battle first, and then Judah, rather than obeying fully and completely, Judah changed God's battle plans and invited Simeon to join them. Remember, they fought a guy named Adonai Bezek. They were victorious. The Lord was with them. But they cut off his thumbs and his big toes, which is what he used to do to his enemies. See, rather than act like Israelites, they immediately began to act like Canaanites. from there. God called all Israel to faithfully obey him, yet we read throughout chapter 1 that Israel could not drive out the inhabitants of the land. Under Joshua, they had victory. After Joshua, they had defeat. So what changed? Israel stopped obeying the Lord. They stopped trusting him. He had shown himself faithful time and time again, yet instead of entering into battle confident the Lord would do it again, they refused to enter into battle. We're told in chapter 1, the Lord was with Judah, yet it also says that Judah could not drive out the inhabitants from the plain. Because, you know, they have iron chariots. Except in chapter 4, God defeated another army with iron chariots. And if you recall, all he did was send rain to defeat them. Judah couldn't take possession because Judah, as a tribe, didn't trust the Lord. So Israel is suddenly unable to be victorious. Instead of taking what God had already given them, Israel had begun grasping for what God had not given. Remember what it meant for Israel to conquer the land, right? They were to devote the inhabitants to complete destruction. But God explains in Deuteronomy 7 what that destruction really means. It means to not marry the Canaanites. It means to not enter into covenants with the Canaanites. Instead of engaging in relationship with the Canaanites, they are to destroy their altars and chop down their pillars used in worship, to burn their asherim, and to destroy their carved images. They were to cleanse the land of its idolatry. That's what it meant to devote the Canaanites to complete destruction. It meant to not engage with them in their idolatry. But rather than obey the Lord and take what God had given them, Israel chose to grasp for what God had not given them. Rather than receive, they chose to grasp for something. We see this right away in chapter 1. In fact, we read this a few months ago about Dan, several months ago. The Amorites pressed the people of Dan back into the hill country, for they did not allow them to come down to the plain. The Amorites persisted in dwelling in Mount Heres and Aijalon and in Shealbim, but the hand of the house of Joseph rested heavily upon them, and they became subject to forced labor. So here we see the tribe of Dan refused to take what God had given them, the territory God had allotted to them. They remained in the hill country rather than going down in the lowland, into the plain. What was there to stop the tribe of Dan from taking the plain? Not the Amorites. What were the Amorites next to God? If Dan would simply enter into the battle in faith, God would give the victory. But they refused to enter the battle in faith. But notice it says that the house of Joseph, remember Joseph had two sons, and those sons each got an allotment. Joseph got a double portion. The tribe of Ephraim is the house of Joseph. Ephraim, which is right next door, they border the tribe of Dan. Ephraim puts those same people Dan couldn't defeat to forced labor. If they could put them to forced labor, why cannot Dan defeat them? Now you understand, to put them to forced labor is to enter into an agreement with them, a covenant. The very thing God said they could not do. I mean, people don't willingly enter into forced labor agreements because they are essentially, hey, give us these things and we won't kill you. Win-win, right? Nobody engages in those willingly. The fact that Ephraim could impose a forced labor arrangement on them indicates they had military superiority over them. They could have defeated them in battle. But rather than take what God had given them, Israel chose to grasp for what he had not given. In this case, it was whatever goods and services the Amorites provided them. So instead of devoting the people to complete destruction, that is, instead of having nothing to do with them and destroying their idolatrous religious furniture, Israel grasped for the prosperity they thought such arrangements would provide. God offered them prosperity. God offered them victory. Rather than receive what God gave them, they grasped for it on their own terms. We see the same grasping later in the book, right, with Gideon. Remember Gideon, he refused the title king, but he grasped for the power and the wealth and the prestige that such a title offered him. Remember, he named his son Abimelech, which means my dad is king. He grasped for personal vengeance when he chased Zeba and Zalmunna over 100 miles on foot. In chapter 8, he grasped for even more prominence when he made the golden ephod and put it on display in his home, no doubt charging people to come and gaze upon this beautiful ephod. Of course, Jephthah grasped for what God had not given by trying to manipulate him with the promise of human sacrifice. God was planning to give the victory, but Jephthah wanted that victory on his own terms because of what he had done. And of course, Samson grasped for whatever in the world he ever wanted and never pursued faithfulness to God. Then you come to chapter 17. The author shifts back to the very beginning of the book, to the time of what's happening in chapter 1, right? So the events in chapters 17 and 18 happen in the timeline of that very first chapter. Remember, Micah steals some silver from his mother. He confesses because she utters a curse against him. She gives him that silver back so that he can make an idol, an image to worship. He does this. He appoints one of his own sons, an Ephraimite, by the way, not a Levite, to be his priest. But then, the news, a wandering Levite happens by and he realizes his opportunity. So he hires this Levite to be his personal priest, assured that the Lord would finally bless him because he hired an unqualified priest. Now in chapter 1, the Danites were unable to defeat the Amorites, even though the Ephraimites had superiority and control over them. So at that time, when they were no longer able to drive them out of the plain, the Danites send scouts to look for a land that would be easier to conquer. Rather than receive what God had given, they chose to grasp for what he had not. So on their way to scout out some land, these spies stopped by Micah's estate. Now, notice, do you remember what happened when they stopped by Micah's estate? We read this in chapter 18. When they were by the house of Micah, they recognized the voice of a young Levite. And they turned aside and said to him, "Who brought you here? And what are you doing in this place? And what is your business here?" They recognized his voice. They heard him speaking, and they knew who he was. Now, the author has not yet revealed the identity of the young Levite's event, who the young Levite is, but these men recognized his voice. At the very least, the young man had something like a celebrity status. They asked him with great incredulity, "Well, why are you here? Of all the places you could be, this is where you are? Priest to a private little individual household? Why would someone as well-known and as prominent as you be in a podunk place like this?" But the young Levite thought he had a great gig. I mean, Micah pays him a decent salary, provides him with lots of clothes to wear, and did you see the ephod he gets to wear? He finally gets to be a priest. Besides, he'd get the idols, the household gods. I mean, what more could a guy want? I mean, other than what God offered. When the scouts returned to their army of 600 soldiers, they told them the land they scouted was ripe for the taking. The people there weren't connected. They had no engagement in any other kingdoms around. It's wide open. It would be a perfect place for them to move their tribe to. Except it's not the land God gave them. But then the scouts tell them about Micah, about the young Levite, about Micah's household gods, about this beautiful ephod he made. And so they show up at Micah's place, and they take these things. The young Levite, thinking he's somebody, demands to know what it is they think they're doing. But here's the response. And they said to him, "Keep quiet. Put your hand on your mouth and come with us and be to us a father and a priest. Is it better for you to be priest in the house of one man or to be priest to a tribe and a clan in Israel?" And the priest's heart was glad. He took the ephod and the household gods and the carved image and went along with the people. You know, I've had some jobs over the years that I didn't particularly enjoy. Often they had difficult working conditions, you know, the kind of environment where you just dread going to work every day. I cannot imagine being in the midst of that, though, and going to a job interview and being told, "Shut up, this is a good offer, you better take it." And then thinking that this is an improvement. If that's how they treat you in a job interview. But notice they appeal to his pride. They ask him, essentially, which is better? Do you want a priest over a single household, or do you want a priest to be a priest for an entire tribe? Do you want to be a small church pastor, or do you want to be a mega church pastor? Right? I mean, if you're a mega church pastor, you get to wear sneakers and be on those special shows. You know what I'm talking about. Rather than receive what God had given him, which, by the way, was service to the priests at the tabernacle, not as a priest. He wasn't of the priestly line. He could serve the priests. He chose to grasp for what God had not given. The author says his heart was glad. I must be somebody. They want me, not my stupid cousins. See, in verse 27, the army take a band. They take Micah's illicit idols, the priest that Micah had ordained, and they go north to the city of Laish. As Will pointed out, Laish was this quiet and unsuspecting people, the very sort of people Israel was supposed to be. Right? They're just quietly going about their lives, doing the things they were supposed to do. Israel, the tribe of Dan, had no warrant to go in and grasp for what God had not given them. They stole land from these people, drove them out of their homes. They then rebuilt the city. The entire tribe moves north with the new city of Dan as their capital. In verse 30, they set up this carved image that they stole, and they established really what is a false priesthood. Again, as Will illustrated last week, the author went all M. Night Shyamalan and gave the big reveal. Right? The young Levite, the one whose voice they recognized, was none other than Jonathan, the son of Gershom, the son of Moses. He's the grandson of Moses. That Moses. But the Moses that doesn't need a last name, right? Everybody knows who Moses is. Moses is the most esteemed man in Israel's history. He's actually greater even than King David. Moses spoke with God face to face as a man speaks with another man. Moses was on the mountaintop receiving the law, the Ten Commandments. He's the lawgiver. He beheld God's glory with his own eyes. He was in God's glory so much that his own skin would shine afterward. And then, of course, in his own M. Night Shyamalan moment, Moses even wrote in Numbers 12 that he was the most humble man on all the earth. No wonder they recognized Jonathan's voice. Being the grandson of Moses made him a celebrity. Everybody knows him. Well, speaking of knowing, surely Jonathan knew the law of Moses. But surely his own family, including his father, the son of Moses, would have taught him the law of Moses. In fact, his second cousin Phinehas was Israel's high priest at the time. Phinehas, by the way, was the young man who in Numbers 25 exhibited great faithfulness and zeal for the Lord. Jonathan, as a member of this extended family, had everything available to him for him to know he should not be a priest, and he certainly should not be a priest with household gods and carved in metal images. But it is Jonathan's vainglory, his desire to be somebody, that leads to his sin against God and against God's people by enabling, in fact, by leading them in their idolatry, their violations of the Ten Commandments. But Jonathan's personal ambition led him to break the very first two requirements of the covenant. Remember, the covenant given to Israel begins with these two requirements. You shall have no other gods before me. Zero. There's no room for any other gods save for Yahweh, God of Israel. You shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above or that is in the earth beneath or that is in the water under the earth. See, the first and second requirements of the covenant God made with Israel through Jonathan's grandfather, personally witnessed by his father Gershom, were completely ignored by Jonathan. In verse 30, the author says, Jonathan and his sons would end up being priests to the tribe of Dan until the day of the captivity of the land, some 500 years or so later. In fact, it was this singular act that led to the destruction of the northern tribes of Israel in response to their rebellion against God and their absolute commitment to idolatry. You fast forward a few hundred years. When the kingdom is split into two, Solomon's son Rehoboam is king of Judah, the south, and then his other son Jeroboam becomes king of the 10 northern tribes. Jeroboam is so concerned that his people would travel to the temple in Jerusalem, that's in his brother's territory, his brother's kingdom, that they would return to the king. So he followed in Jonathan's footsteps. He walks down the path Jonathan made for him, and he did this to prevent his people from returning to his brother, the king of Judah. So the king, this Jeroboam, took counsel and made two calves of gold. And he said to the people, you have gone up to Jerusalem long enough. Behold your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt. And he set one in Bethel and the other put in Dan. Then this thing became a sin, for the people went as far as Dan to be before one. It is Jonathan's pride, that is his selfish ambition, that would ultimately lead to the destruction of Israel. That the 10 northern tribes would be largely exiled elsewhere by the Assyrian Empire, and they would assimilate into those people groups. And the few of them who did remain in the land would Assyria moved into the land, exiles from other nations. Eventually, their offspring would be known as the Samaritans. And our culture tells us we should pursue everything with utter abandon, to give ourselves fully and completely to our desires, whether that's sexual desires or our fitness goals. We're told to pursue our career and our financial goals first and foremost, for when we achieve those, then we'll have a life that actually is worth living. We're constantly bombarded with this idea that we should have everything, that the primary goal of life is to have every hope and dream in our lives achieved. Every desire you've ever had, you should have fulfilled. So we come up with a bucket list of the things we want to accomplish. You know, there are even preachers out there who will tell you that you are supposed to live your best life now. By the way, that guy is almost right. You're supposed to live your second best life now, because you only get two. The fact is, everything we hope and dream for, everything we desire is coming, but it's coming when the Lord Jesus returns and he recreates the world. It will be here in its fullness one day. We see this constant desire people have for fame, right? We post on social media, and then we check back for how many likes or how many reposts we get, as if someone somewhere is keeping score. Everyone wants to go viral, it seems, and so what was once a candid moment caught on camera now becomes elaborately staged, you know, a fake situation. People have carefully curated online profiles, all in hopes of becoming an influencer. Of what? I don't know. Sadly, we see this in ministry, too, with men who've been set apart for the office of elder. Elders who labor at preaching and teaching. Men whom Paul says should be worthy of double honor, and they pursue ministry out of selfish ambition. This is what Jonathan did. He wanted to be a priest. He wanted to be a prominent priest. Far better to lead people, more people in worship, not less, right? I mean, who can argue with that? But Jonathan's name means Yahweh has given. Not a great name to have. Yahweh has given. How great that Jonathan is now able to give back to the Lord. Except he's not giving back to the Lord. He's grasping. He's not supposed to be a priest. He's supposed to be an assistant to his cousins who are priests. They descend from their grandfather Aaron. Jonathan descends from Aaron's brother Moses. Only Aaron's offspring are to be the priests. The Levites were given a supportive role, but rather than take what God had given, Jonathan grasps for what God has not given. And hundreds of years later, his selfish ambition remains unchecked, and all Israel follows after his example, after his selfish ambition, and they worship these golden idols Jeroboam is going to place in a false temple in the city of Dan. But we see this in vocational ministry all the time. We see men pursue things out of selfish ambition. Don't like Jonathan, it's always in the name of the Lord. Right? We know we can't say, yeah, I'm in ministry totally for me and all the benefits of it. Right. You can't say that. So what do you say? When we put a veneer over our selfish ambition and say, hey, I'm just trying to grow Christ's church. If I could be used for his glory, that's great. I'm just trying to reach the lost. And then that man proceeds to do whatever it takes to achieve his selfish ambition, regardless of the number of men and women he ends up hurting. This is how we end up with men like Bill Hybels, Mark Driscoll, Ravi Zacharias, or even Billy Graham's grandson, Tully Chivision. These are all highly ambitious men whose ambition led them to do terrible things. In fact, you know, Mark Driscoll once said that the Mars Hill bus, that was the name of his church, the Mars, behind the body of the Mars Hill bus was a pile of bodies. And he even said that one day, by God's grace, that pile will be a mountain. He claims, of course, that the ambition was a personal ambition. It was ministerial ambition. He wants to do great things for the Lord. But he didn't merely hurt ministries. He hurt people. I'll never forget this singular class in seminary. And I don't mean the course. I mean this moment in a particular class. It was a singular, seminal moment for me, that shaped my understanding of life and of ministry. Dr. Gomez, he was a great class. He was walking us through some New Testament passage, working through the grammar. And I don't remember the text, but I remember that somehow the discussion got onto the topic of selfish ambition. I'm in a class of like 30, maybe 35 students, mostly young men who are pursuing vocational ministry. Dr. Gomez took a moment, he paused, and he looked at each one of us, making sure that he caught our eye, every one of us. And then he explained to us what was going to happen for many of us after seminary. Many of us, he said, would get the only job we can get with zero experience and only a, you know, massive student loan bill, likely a youth pastor role at a small church. The pay would be quite inadequate, so the entire time you're at that church, he says, you're going to be looking for another job. And after you get a few years of ministry experience, you might be offered a better job, maybe a youth pastor position at a larger church. Of course, we don't want to be youth pastors, so most of that time will also be spent looking for a better job. But then he says, you're going to find an assistant pastor role at a smaller church again. So now, finally, in your ministry, you're going to deal with adults and therefore adult problems, but inevitably, as there is, as happens, there's going to be some conflict with people. But hey, you've been looking for another job the whole time anyway. And then he says, well, you're going to move on from that role to a larger church again, probably like an assistant pastor role. And after a few years and more interpersonal conflict, largely due to your immaturity and lack of commitment to those people, you're going to accept a senior pastoral position at a much smaller church. But we're not satisfied small. So the entire time we're in this role as a senior pastor, we're just trying to build a resume, and as soon as we have enough years under our belt, we can move on to a larger church. And besides, the number of conflicts with people started to grow. It's getting too big, too unwieldy. But that larger church, he says, we're still going to be looking for bigger and better, but not, by now the pattern is firm. We won't commit to a group of people. There will be friction, and people will be hurt. But hey, that much larger church, that's the issue to call. These people aren't my problem anymore. They don't have to like me. And then he said, if you make it all the way to retirement, serving churches 3 to 5 years at a time, there will be a string of hurting and injured people left behind. Men and women for whom Christ died. Men and women you have injured because of your selfishness, your selfish ambition. People who are hurt deeply by you, by your lack of love, by your lack of commitment to them. And then he said something that shocked the entire classroom into stunned silence. He said, if that is your ambition, then God damn your ambition. Selfish ambition always, always brings harm. You may not see the harm in the short term. It may be a longer term impact. But selfish ambition always brings harm. Now, it's particularly dangerous in vocational ministry because of the roles that we have, right? It is very deadly in that, right? Jonathan, the grandson of Moses, is a clear example of this. But we see selfish ambition all over the place in the church. It's not just those who are in a particular office in the church. Every member can be led by and motivated by selfish ambition. I'm sure we've all heard stories of people who start ministries in their local churches and soon act as though they own that particular ministry. But listen, God is not an emperor. See, an emperor is, his empire is made up of smaller kingdoms. There are no smaller kingdoms. There's only one king in the kingdom of Christ. There's only one king. His name is Jesus. He's not JT or Jim or Dan or Pat or Jane or Ryan or Taylor or Anna or Scott. Those names are totally random. Far too many folk end up acting like the area in which they serve belongs to them as if it exists to give them meaning and purpose, or it's their means for boosting themselves in the eyes of others. We see selfish ambition in how some people try to give to their local church. I've heard of wealthy individuals at other churches who have wanted to steer the church in a particular direction, so instead of giving to the church, they give to the ministry they want supported. So they designate their offerings. Maybe they think the church will spend more money on missions. And so all of their offerings go to missions. Or maybe they should be in youth ministry. So all of their offerings go to youth ministry. Or I think we should build. So I'm going to designate my vast offerings to a building fund. Or I don't like the direction this church is going. So I'm not going to give anything. Rather than trust the Lord and the leadership he's put in place, they make it their personal ambition to adjust the direction of the church through offerings. Listen, we see selfish ambition in marriage when one spouse seeks what he or she wants from the other or makes decisions without regard for the other person. You know, a man can be entirely faithful to his wife physically and maybe even never use pornography, and yet that man can be broken entirely sexually because he looks to his wife selfishly. or vice versa. Or maybe a spouse ignores the other spouse in pursuit of personal hobbies or me time with my friends. We see selfish ambition with parents and their children. How many parents push their children into sports in order to validate their own image in the eyes of their peers? Not the kids' peers, the parents' peers. Or they push them to excel in academics, not for the child, but so that they look good as parents. Parents who seek to control every life decision of their children, even their grown children, are selfishly ambitious. They want their children to make wise choices, not because the choice is wise, but because if the kids make wise choices, it reflects well on the parents for raising such wise children. Look, selfish ambition, whether it's in the home or in the workplace or it's in the church or it's in personal relationships, is idolatry. It is taking something good, your area of service or the thing that God has given you to do, and it's elevating that thing to an ultimate position that is the most important thing in the world to you. That's what an idol is. Rarely is an idol something evil in and of itself. It's usually a good thing that we're too greatly devoted to. We elevate that thing. Just because an activity can be called ministry doesn't mean it can't be done from selfish ambition. Listen, selfish ambition rears its ugly head in all sorts of relationships. Anytime a person approaches a relationship with a me-first attitude, selfish ambition is wreaking havoc. It may take a while to notice it, but it's wreaking havoc. See, that's what selfish ambition is. It is the desire to gain everything for yourself without regard for anyone else, for how it may harm them. I knew this was going to happen. Consider with me Paul's words in his letter to the Philippians. Do nothing from selfish ambition or conceit, but in humility count others more significant than yourselves. Let each of you look not only to his own interests, but also to the interests of others. Do you see the opposite of selfish ambition? It's counting others more significant than yourself. It isn't a wholesale denial of personal ambition or the fruit of one's own labor and effort. Paul says, look to your own ambitions, your own interests. Do that. But also, he says, look to the interests of others. One of the things I love about our church is how we have married folk, and we have single folk, and we have families, and many of them have sacrificed time and money and energy to help out the single parent or the young married couple or the single person, regardless of the person's age, all of whom struggle in a variety of ways. We have people who have come alongside others and have assisted them, not merely by giving money, though it has been that happens, but we walk alongside them. We give our most precious resource of all. We give each other our time. That's an amazing gift. This is what it means to count others more significant than yourselves. Again, Paul says, look to your own interests. I know at least a couple guys here who are looking for promotions to better provide for their families. Paul says, pursue that. Work hard to get that raise. But he also says to all of us, don't just look to your own interests. Look to the interests of others. Don't let your personal ambition become your selfish ambition. You see, ambition is not the problem. It's a smarty word for the kiddos. As I said at the start, many men and women throughout history have been ambitious. They have brought about great good in this world. This world. What we're looking for here is godly ambition. For godly ambition benefits not only this world, but the next one. You know, Paul goes on to say in the same letter that to tell the Philippians to be like Jesus, because Jesus did not look out for his own interests. Instead, he took on the form of a servant in order to be able to die for his people. Be like that, Paul says. Be the kind of person who would lay down your life for the interests of other people. Sacrifice whatever needs to be sacrificed for the good of others. We actually see Paul himself doing this, pursuing godly ambition. Chapter 3, after he lists all of his bona fides, and in the first century, people would have been like, wow, that's quite a list. Things like, he's a Jew, he was so zealous for the law, he was a Pharisee. In fact, when it came to the law of Moses, he said he was blameless. And he wasn't lying. But then he writes this, but whatever gain I had, I counted as loss for the sake of Christ. Indeed, I count everything as loss because of the surpassing worth of knowing Christ Jesus my Lord. For his sake, I have suffered the loss of all things and count them as rubbish in order that I may gain Christ and be found in him, not having a righteousness of my own that comes from the law, but that which comes through faith in Christ, the righteousness from God that depends on faith, that I may know him and the power of his resurrection and may share in his sufferings, becoming like him in his death, that by any means possible I may attain the resurrection from the dead. Do you see Paul's ambition here? Paul wants to do great things for the Lord. He wants to dedicate his life to ministry. But he gladly embraced suffering in order to bring that about. Listen, if you ever hear a preacher talk about all the wonderful things God wants to bless you with in your life, and he doesn't include suffering among them, don't listen to another word, because that is not the apostolic deposit that has been passed on. Paul's ambition was to be like Christ, to be formed by him, that the righteousness given him in Christ through faith would begin to permeate every area of his life. Now, here's how you can know your ambition is godly ambition. It's a simple question. In your pursuit of it, are you becoming more like Christ? Is your life demonstrating increasing fruit of the Spirit? I mean, when you think of the ministry you serve in, a way that you serve your church or whatever, or your people in your community, whatever it is, in the area you serve, are you filled with increasing measures of love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control? Is that growing in you? When you think about your work, are you filled with these things in increasing measure? When you interact with others in the church or that annoying neighbor down the street, do these characteristics begin to dominate your discourse, your life with them in community? Godly ambition, by its very nature, evidences the Spirit of God at work in you. So when you look at the things you enjoy, some people enjoy politics, okay, taste his own. Or you enjoy sports, or you work, or your entertainment, or whatever it is. Even your relationships. What is the fruit that is being seen in that? Is it anger? Malice? Indignation? Personal offense? Do you feel like your rights are being trampled on? Are you primarily concerned about taking power and seeking control over a situation? Paul says, be like Jesus. Because even though he was God in every way, he did not consider equality with God something to be grasped. Instead, he embraced the form of a servant. He suffered and he died for his people. So be like him. Embrace godly ambition in all you do. Pursue love. Pursue joy. Pursue peace and patience and kindness and goodness and faithfulness and gentleness and self-control. Pursue Jesus. That is godly ambition. If we will embrace godly ambition, the church will benefit, which means the entire world will benefit, because godly ambition is a kingdom ambition. Godly ambition is gospel ambition. Godly ambition pursues Christ with utter abandon. This is the ambition we